We're doing revenue first, huh?
So I'm going to call the meeting to order here. This is a joint committee on ways and means for information technology. And today is March the 3rd.
That's correct.
All right. I got it right. So welcome. And tell us what we're doing today.
Senator Riley and members of the committee, today we have two agencies that are going to present an IT profile of their agency. First, we'll start with the Oregon Department of Revenue, and then the Public Employees Retirement System will close out the session. So with that, will the folks from the Oregon Department of Revenue come forward? We have Terrence Woods, who serves as the Chief Information Officer for the Department of Revenue. At some point, I'm sure Terrence will bring up Eric Smith, who is the program management office manager, also responsible for the core system replacement project. And finally, Mike Vaughn, who works in the property tax division. He'll be talking to us about the property valuation system.
Great. So whenever you're ready.
Okay. Thank you, co-chairs, member of the committee, and for the record, thank you, Sean. I am Terrence Woods, and I am the Administrative Services Division Administrator and CIO for the Department of Revenue. My goal today is really just to give you a high-level overview of ITS and the folks that we serve in the agency, and then a little bit later in the presentation, I'm going to ask Mr. Smith and Mr. Vaughn to come up to talk about two of our major projects that we're either working on or going to be working on in the future. As you can see here, we have four divisions that we support. We are 69 FTE with a budget of $22.5 million. We also take care of eight field locations throughout the state. Some of them obviously bigger and smaller. Portland's obviously bigger than our one person Coos Bay location that we have, but we do take care of those locations as well. In addition, the agency program management office and the director's office. Our mission, I won't read the mission and vision, but really the thing I want to emphasize here is when I started with revenue in 2012, I really wanted us to have practicalness to what we do. And I'll say that in air quotes, practicalness. And I didn't want us to operate under what should be, but where are we and how do we progress forward as an IT organization? And so our mission is really to provide those practical solutions, be reliable support. We don't have to be bleeding edge. And in some cases, that actually works against us trying to be bleeding edge in government and IT. And so that is our mission. And our vision is really, as we increase the capacity, as our business partners come to us looking for automation solutions, I wanted to ensure that we had the capacity to take that work on, both in resources, skill set, maturity of our processes, and also modernization of our technologies. And so for the Department of Revenue, nothing fancy, but we really do look to have reliable, practical support and have a capacity in terms of our vision for our business partners. I apologize for my voice. I should have said that in advance. I've been fighting the flu the past 5 days, and so I've been told I have a face for radio, and so I finally have a voice to go with it. So I'll enjoy that while it lasts. Our role, it was very important that the team understood what our role was. And really, it's provide that business value, but not only through the technologies, because I think sometimes we in IT get confused that we think we're in the business of technology, and that's not why we're there. So it's also important that we mature our processes and we get and develop our workforce as well. And so that is our role. I laid out six objectives. You only see five there because one of them we've actually done, and that was create and maintain an enterprise architecture plan. We had to do this primarily in response to getting the core system replacement readiness done, but also as an ongoing means to ensure that our agency mission and goals, and as we try to stay disciplined in best practices with our day-to-day and operations, that we do work from an enterprise architecture plan. So that one's not on there, but know that that took place as well. Point out just the developed ITS workforce. You will see later on when I cover briefly some of the certifications the team has worked on. This is actually one of our key performance indicators for the agency in terms of annual training. And you'll see later on in the presentation that I'm very proud of the team and the work they've done, both individually, collectively, on behalf of the agency, in terms of developing their knowledge and skill set, not only for the jobs that they're doing, but for the jobs that they will have to do going forward in the future. Real quickly, the organization structure, I have two direct reports, one being the Chief Technology Officer, who also serves as a Deputy CIO. We organized by functions. The main reason I did that is, much like I covered the role of ITS, I wanted each area to understand what their role was on the team. And so I didn't want them to have to figure out, well, I do this part-time and I also do something else part-time. I wanted to really break the team up in functions so that not only our business partners could understand, but also they could understand the role that they played on the team. The other direct report I have is my information security officer, who also manages our shared services team. And the shared services, I will touch on that briefly just to say that that's where our project managers reside, our project coordinators reside, our business analysts reside, as well as our senior portfolio analysts. And so these folks really have their hands not only in what our business partners' requests come to us, but also all of the different functions on the IT team. They're sort of the glue that holds that all together. The functions, engineering services, you have all of the databases that team maintains. Primarily, it's iSeries. As you know, we're in the middle of a major project that will quickly turn to SQL databases. But for now, it's a lot of DB2 databases in the iSeries. Middleware for our web servers, application configuration, they do a lot of those things. And then in terms of desktop engineering, our application installs, our desktop-based builds. So as we deploy PCs out to the various business areas, this team puts together those builds for the actual desktop. Application services. Currently, we service over 245 custom applications. 33% roughly of those will be remaining after the Gentax implementation. But we are actively working, to come up with a plan so that we can get completely off the iSeries platform. I mean, as you know, it doesn't matter if I have 100 people on the plane or one person on the plane, I still got to have somebody to service it as long as that platform is up and running. And so while we won't be off of that platform at the end of the project, we are working towards getting off that platform because that helps make us more efficient and focus on our new platform that we're going to be on going forward. Information security, I touched on that. I've asked that team to really put in a program. Information security can tend to be very reactive, and I want us to be more proactive, and so we've been putting a lot of work into education awareness, you know, sometimes breaches occur not because of the technology, but because of the folks that are actually working at the desk. And so we want to make sure our workforce is educated and aware of the things that are out there and things that could happen, and have a healthy skepticism about the things that pop up on their browser. Or if you see a pile of a flash drive laying in a parking lot, you might not want to go ahead and put that in your PC when you get back to work. And so really putting a lot of work effort into education and awareness for our workforce. I've touched on shared services, support services. This is really the voice of organization when folks have things that are broken or they need fixed. They call our service desk, our tier one. They take care of as many of the calls they can on the first call. Sometimes they do need to escalate those to one of the other teams that I've covered previously. We also have system support analysts in that group, and they do a lot of the application for some of our iSeries platforms. They do a lot of the troubleshooting around the applications for that. And then our production control. So a lot of the jobs that run at night, our production control unit ensures that those jobs didn't have any errors. If they did, who do they escalate them with? They work with the data center quite a bit to ensure that our jobs do get through so that when folks come in the morning, they're ready to work. Certifications, why is this important? Our director and deputy director, as I said earlier, around KPIs, we have one around employee engagement, we have another around annual training. The team really took that to heart. They've worked really hard, not only to go to some of the classes and get that training, but also some of them even spent their own money to get some of these certifications, not only because it's the right thing to do and it helps them in their job, but also it's their commitment to the agency. One of the things I'm very proud about this team is they all understand why we're in business at the Department of Revenue. I was very impressed when I started at Revenue and how much the IT team understood the business that we're in, which is a huge help when you're talking about enterprise architecture or mission, vision, and goals. It didn't take them long to get there. So since 2012, this group has earned over 56 certifications in varying areas. And I will sit here before you today and say that it has helped not only in our readiness, it continues to help us on our day-to-day operations and maintenance of the team. And last, but definitely not least, this thing we call governance. The first one up there, agency mission, vision, values, division, program strategies. Put that up there because there is a cross-divisional team that determines the work requests that come to IT. As I said earlier, we're not in the business of IT, we're in the business of tax administration. And so as that cross-divisional team has work requests that come to us, we make estimates on that work, and that's how we get work into the queue. And not talking about the day-to-day operations of IT, but as work requests come from those business areas, they are in charge of that work, they do govern that work. It is facilitated by our agency program office, but there is a cross-divisional team in place. Information technology infrastructure, otherwise known as IDLE. I put that up there because we also need to work on maturing our day-to-day operations. And so the best one, I feel, one of the best ways to do that is to work from a framework. So our service management and how we look at it in terms of how we handle incidents, this is where our change management process comes in. So as you have one change in one system, how do you know it's not going to affect another system that you have? As systems become more integrated, your change management process, your release management process becomes even more important. And so we will continue to mature using IDLE as our framework, which obviously brings in some of the best practices as well. And then the last piece of this is enterprise architecture. And I feel this is what really binds those two things together to provide us with a roadmap. And it's really the destination that you don't get to if you're staying current on your enterprise architecture plan. You should be constantly looking forward in turn responding to the vision, program strategies, and your maturity as it relates to IDLE. And so you got to constantly update that, which we do annually at the Department of Revenue. So between those three is how we govern our work in ITS. One obviously has a heavy business customer base. One is heavy in terms of best practices in the framework of which we work from. And the last piece is enterprise architecture to create our roadmap and ensure that we're still directionally correct on what we set out to do. Before I ask Mr. Smith to come up, is there any questions I can answer for you now?
Doesn't look like it.
Okay.
Oh,
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Nierman.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. So, do you interface with the federal government at all with your software at all, or?
Co-chairs, member of the committee, Representative Nierman, we do not interface with the federal at all in terms of our software. Other than obviously we have IRS audits and things that we need to respond with. We do take everything they say under advisement, but in terms of integration with their software, we don't at this time.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Eric.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Eric Smith, and I am the administrator of the Program Management Office at the Department of Revenue. And I'm pleased to be able to provide an update of our core systems replacement project that I know a couple of you are familiar with. If you could go, please. You gave me the driver.
I can drive. Here we go.
Next. Give you an overview of the project. Talk a little bit about the business drivers. Why is it that we need to replace our systems? We've already had one of our first four rollouts completed. Talk a little bit about that rollout, some of the things we've seen already in our operations as a result of that, and give you an update on rollout two, which we're in the middle of right now. And I'm happy to entertain questions either during the presentation or at the end. Our initial business case, which we began in 2009, the primary business driver for this project is, as we administer the revenue programs, the over 30 programs that we're responsible for administering, we generate about $8 billion a year, and the infrastructure that we were using for these systems was getting more and more difficult to maintain, primarily because of the platform it's on. It's very difficult to find people who know COBOL technology. The systems were built very well in their day. They've been very reliable for us, and they've just served their time. And so we were looking to really do a capital reinvestment of our infrastructure. But the other benefit that we've had is because there's technology that's out there, a commercial off-the-shelf solution is available in our workspace, and so we were able to look to technology that was hopefully going to be sustainable well into the future. And by doing that, there's opportunities for us to improve our performance, to actually improve the way we do our business with the modern technology. The pipeline graph that you see up there, our first rollout, we implemented on November 12th of 2014, the corporation tobacco and cigarette tax programs. That went live on schedule, and I'll talk a little about that in a moment. As Terrence mentioned, at the end of the day, when we get through the next three rollouts, our last rollout is planned to be in the fall of 2017. We will have replaced about two-thirds of our legacy systems and roughly $80 million total cost for the project. About $65 million of that is implementation costs. We're using bond financing for a good portion of this, which I'll talk about in a moment. About $9 million of the cost that we're paying is interest on those bonds through 2024. Next slide. So reinvestment in our application infrastructure, maintain current revenue streams, that's the primary business driver. But where we can improve in performance, we'll be able to enhance some of the compliance strategies and some of the ways that we handle revenue at the Department of Revenue. We'll be part of a network of states. The Gentax application that we've purchased has been in place now in 20 other state revenue agencies around the country. We are the 19th to adopt it. And there's an incredible network that we are now a part of to talk with other states. What are they finding is successful? What are they finding with fraud? What is going on in their community that we can benefit from? And so that's a big benefit as well as the tools that we're receiving to be able to do our business.
So who's the vendor of this product?
Mr. Chair, Fast Enterprises, which is out of Denver, Colorado.
Okay, mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, they've been doing this since around 2000 or 2001. We're also able to automate a number of processes that we do manually right now, and so we're able to increase efficiency in a number of our program areas and improve our business processes. We're able to provide a better customer experience as well. We have a web portal with this system that's able to offer access for our customers to their accounts, to make payments, to be able to change addresses, things that they aren't able to do for the most part in all of our programs. We've had some web access for our personal income tax program to date, but we're going to be able to offer these features for all of our customers to the extent it makes sense to do so. And then the last bullet, as you can imagine, when you have over 200 systems, legacy systems now, if there are policy changes that you make or that the governor asks for and that we need to change, one of the biggest challenges is making sure that your legacy infrastructure is going to continue to provide those services when you make changes. We spend a great deal of time testing legacy systems, and one of the beauties of having an integrated tax solution and a data warehouse that's in one system that's configurable, where you're not building it, but you're configuring a system out of the box, is it will be, for the most part, easier for us to change and much quicker for us to test, depending on the nature of the change in the new system. So we should be able to be more flexible to respond to the policy choices that you're making. Next slide. This is just a typical screen in our legacy environment. It's a green screen environment. The challenge with this environment is, in order to move around, you need to know where you're headed. You need to know the code that you're going to insert, and you need to know in advance where you're going to go. And this is just one screen from multiple systems that are in this environment. And so you need to have multiple systems up at one time for some job functions and to navigate back and forth between those systems. Next slide. This is a screenshot of our new system. It's a much more intuitive Windows-based system. You can see the tabs there. And this data, by the way, is just mock data. It's not actual taxpayer data. And once you learn what the different functions are within the different tabs or the different types of information that you're going to find on each of those tabs, it's a much quicker system to learn. And this look and feel is the same throughout the system. So regardless of where you're at, you're on an account screen here, but if you're on a search screen or on a payment screen, this look and feel is the same, and you can navigate very quickly. The things that are highlighted in blue are things you can drill down on and go deeper into the system just with the click of a button. And so it's a very robust integrated system that our staff that are currently using are enjoying quite a bit. Next slide. So an overview of Rollout 1. We had over 1,200 business requirements that we had identified going into this project for all of the programs and all four rollouts. And around 1,100 of those were in scope for the three programs in Rollout 1. And we were able to satisfy all the relevant scope requirements so we could provide the functions and services we needed for those programs for Rollout 1. But there's also a great deal of work that you're doing with your legacy systems. So your legacy systems were supporting those programs. Those legacy systems in many cases support other programs. And so we had to either retire legacy systems or have current legacy systems that we're still using not recognize activities for the corporation cigarette and tobacco tax programs because we're now doing them in the new system. And we had to make changes to our systems and then test those as well so that when we went live in November, our legacy environment behaved the way it needed to, and our new environment behaved the way it needed to. And a great deal of work was done in legacy and will continue to go on through each of these rollouts. We tested the functionality of the new system before we went live. It was very functional. It continues to be functional. I'll talk about that in just a moment. One of the things we're striving to do throughout this project is to avoid doing customization. In other words, there's code that's in the it's in the box, if you will, for the COT solution. And to the extent we can just configure the system, it's going to be a lot easier for us to maintain down the road. And so we're trying very hard not to customize any of the Gentax solution for our business needs. And we're very pleased, at least for the first three programs in the first rollout, we were able to do that. We configured the system, and then the big key is we change our business processes to be able to adapt to the functionality that's in the new system instead of trying to customize the system to do business the way we used to. We went live November 12th. That was on schedule. Everything was working. And I guess the last thing I'd report is we were under budget at that time, and we continue to operate under budget for this biennium for the first rollout and as we work on the second rollout.
So typically when we do a new policy, you are going to have to change your system in some way. So we're going to have those custom modules probably stuck on this system. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chair, the system, if we make policy changes, so like every year there are changes to tax laws, especially as we connect to federal tax law, we can configure the system. And it's not customization. We just can go into the system and just change the business rules in the system to be able to make the changes to the policy changes that take place. And from my experience, I've been with the Revenue Department for over 25 years. The vast majority of the changes that you will be making with the existing systems are things that we should be able to configure. This system, not only is it in 20 revenue agencies, it's also in other countries and does other municipal jurisdictions, and they actually are able to perform over 900 different tax types with this system. So it's very configurable, and we should be able to accommodate a lot of our needs at a fairly low cost for policy changes.
Good, thank you.
Yes, you're welcome. New tax programs are out of scope with our contracts, so those kinds of things we would have to address. One of the things I want to touch base on is just the impact of Gentax. As I mentioned, we had 1,200 business requirements that we thought of before we had procured a vendor. You know, since November and as of mid-February, we've banked almost $600 million in the new system. We bank everything in Gentax, and then we pass back to the legacy systems, and so personal income tax is still in the legacy system, those funds, and they go to those systems, and then we keep the revenues in the system for corporate and tobacco. We've issued over 20,000 notices and issued 1,700 refunds, and so the system is working. We are doing our business in the system for the three programs that are in there. And so our business requirements that we had for how to conduct our work have been met. But in addition to that, things that we hadn't thought about that came with the solution is real-time processing. So when a payment is made or something is posted to the system, an audit is uploaded to the system, in our old system, you would have to wait for an overnight batch process. And in some cases, depending on the complexity of the transaction, you might have to do two or three overnight batch processes until you can complete your transaction. And with the new system, it's real time. And so when an auditor enters something or somebody at our service desk receives a phone call or takes a payment and they enter it in the system, it shows on their account right away. We're able to do risk scoring. So we've always had refund review policies if we're going to be releasing refunds. But there's with the integrated system and the data warehouse, we're able to do some analytics to be able to look at what are the risks of some of these refunds going out. Do we need to have another set of eyes look at these? Whose eyes should be looking at these refunds? Another feature that's very well liked is we can see an exact copy of the correspondence that the system generated. So if the system generates a notice and sends it to a taxpayer and they either call the office or they walk into a field office, there's an account, they can look it up and we can see that correspondence right there, whether they're on the phone or whatever. And so we can see the correspondence that the taxpayer has in their hand when they make the phone call. I mentioned a little bit about the enhanced online services. We're really excited about that. The drill down feature I touched on the slide, where wherever you're at, even if you're looking at a report and you want to look at where did these payments come from in the report, you can click down into some of those reports and see here are where those payments came from, or if you're in the accounting system. The drill down features, because it's an integrated system, are really remarkable for how you can navigate the system to try and find the source of what it is you're looking for. And then the last thing I would just share is to be able to pull up an original return, and then if a taxpayer files an amended return, and to have them side by side in front of you instead of sending for a file request and trying to get some paper a few days later is just remarkable. To be able to have the information, the system supports our ability to see amended returns, prior year returns, and so you can, even then if you've made audit adjustments, and then you can see what your audit adjustments look like compared to the original return. And so the visibility to the work we do is quite remarkable with the new system. Now, I've told you about all the great things about a COT solution. There are also, with any commercial off-the-shelf solution, there are things that are, and there's a great deal of benefit, but there are things that are different and things that are actually more work. So, for example, for us, the one example I would share is we're used to exporting data out of our legacy systems to help with legislative revenue office work or economic forecasts, and we understood our legacy systems very well. This system is very complex and very integrated, and so it just is taking a great deal more work to understand this system, to see how the data is working in the system, to be able to extract it so that we can make the same assumptions with this data out of Gentax for helping us make our determinations with economic forecasts and things like that. And so it does take more work for some of the things that we're doing in the system, but it's a very small bit of the work that we're doing. The vast majority of the things that we're benefiting from the system are improvements. Keys to success, just thought we'd share. We get asked a lot about what are the things that have helped you be successful, and I would point out three or four things. And one is we had a lot of time to prepare, and some of it wasn't asked for. We originally had asked to try to go live in 2012, and we were delayed until 2013 when you approved the project. In that extra year, Terrence's team was able to really make sure that the technical environment was ready, work with ETS to make sure their environment was ready, so that when the vendor showed up in the fall of 2013, we were ready to go. We were also able to really hone our project management plans, and so the things, and we use our plans, and so the things that we needed for managing risk, managing schedule, managing vendor contracts, we were able to put in place, and they've been very helpful for us to manage the project. But probably the two things that I've learned in this project, and it's on the right side, there are multiple mock data conversions. FAST has an implementation methodology that is remarkable, and it is that you can start converting and practice converting slices of your data as soon as you have the system configured to see how is the data from your legacy system going to behave in the new system. Because one of the greatest risks with a large IT project like this is how is your data conversion going to happen and how will the data behave in your new system. We did eight or nine mock conversions over about 4 or 5 months before we went live. And our last two mock conversions were full mock conversions with the data that we were going to migrate into the new system. And each time we did that, we would find anomalies. We found, I think, a little over 30 different types of data anomalies. And when we would find them, we would understand what was causing them, and then we would address them. We would find mitigation strategies so that when we brought it into the new system, the data that we converted from our legacy system would behave the way we wanted it to. And so that's one big key, is multiple mock conversions. And then the other one is there's a staging environment in the new system that looks identical to the production environment. And so several weeks before we went live, we had the staging environment. It was mostly built. We were still refining it as we would learn things along the way about how it was behaving. But we would take our data stream, so payments, returns that were being brought into process that we were processing through our legacy systems, and after we ran them through our legacy systems, we would take that same data stream and run it through the new system and have the people who work on those actually work on their job in the new system, and then they would see how did the new system behave to do that job. That does two things. One, they learn how to do their job in a new environment because processes change, and then they were able to identify things that maybe weren't working the way they thought they should, and they would tell us, and then we can continue to configure the system. So a functional staging environment and mock conversions, I think, are two really big keys to the success we've had. Next. Roll out too briefly. Those are the five programs that are in scope. Personal income tax is the big one. We had about 125,000 customers in the first rollout. We have 3.5 million customers in the second rollout. And so there's an incredible data conversion process that's going on for this rollout. Self-employed transit program, estates and trusts, senior disabled and deferral, and emergency communications are the other four programs that are included in this rollout. We're going to continue to try to implement these programs without customizing so that it'll be easier for us to maintain the system into the future. By this Friday, we'll have our go-live date for the fall picked. We've got the ranges narrowed down. We have a meeting tomorrow to nail that down, but we will go live again this fall. And if our Ways and Means budget request is addressed, we should be in good shape for our budget for 15-17 as well. And to the budget, the green column there addresses our ask. That very top line is just to report costs. Those are embedded in our normal agency budget. But if you see the general fund, we're going to be asking for a little over $4 million in general fund, primarily for S&S and ETS and maintenance and support costs. And then the bulk of the funding that we need is bond financed. And so just under $27 million in funding, being able to use the bond proceeds that we receive next biennium. We will be asking for one more position this biennium. The data conversion effort is greater than we thought it was, and so we're asking for one more permanent position for the next 2 years to help us with that. And the size of the next two rollouts is enormous, and we need a little bit more space, so we're asking for roughly $200,000 for additional space to house everybody for the testing and training portions of the project. Oops. And I think that was it for my presentation.
So are these systems housed in the data center, or are they housed, where are they housed?
Mr. Chair, yes. We've been working very closely with ETS, the data center, and that's where the application is housed, yes.
Okay. Anything? Yes, Representative Nearman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Smith, what's the bonding, the debt finance cost, sir? What is that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nearman, are you looking at the early slide about the $9 million?
The last slide, yeah, that one there. You have $26 million in debt financed.
Oh, in the green column there?
Right.
So the total project costs are going to be around $32 million next biennium, and we're financing the $26.7 million. We're asking for bonds to be sold so that then we could take that funding and use it for the project, and then we'll repay those bonds until, I think, November of 2024 is how long. They're seven-year bonds, and they're issued about once a year.
Can I follow? So this is, you're treating this as like kind of a capital project then. It's a software acquisition, but you're treating it as like a long-term big cap item then, like buying a building or something like that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nierman, correct. We work closely with DAS Finance to identify what costs were eligible for a capital acquisition and to use financing to pay for this project. Yes.
Can I follow again?
One more.
I'm interested in that. Why is it split then? Why didn't you bond the whole thing? Was some of it not eligible, and what is eligible?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nierman, exactly. There are some costs that, per accounting and financial rules, and we met with DAS and went over what was the nature of those costs, are just not eligible for financing.
So we need to get going because we have someone else to go after you guys. So
ready. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Riley, Representative Nathan, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mike Vaughn, and I'm the valuation manager at the Department of Revenue. Because this is the first opportunity we've had to discuss the Property Valuation System, or PVS, we thought we'd begin with a high-level overview of the work we do in the Property Tax Division, the current appraisal applications that we use to do that work, the challenges we have with those applications, as well as the opportunity of obtaining commercially developed appraisal software that could bring us into industry standards, project costs associated with doing that endeavor, and then finally a timeline of what we anticipate to implement that kind of project. So our evaluation program consists of two main project or program areas. The first is central assessment. This is the valuation of companies who are identified as being in a utility business, airlines, railroads, communication companies, telephone companies, cable companies, internet companies. Department appraised in 2014 approximately 600 companies. We generated a roll value of about $20 billion in real market value. The second program that we have responsibility over is commonly referred to as the industrial program. This is about 850 industrial sites, all valued at over $1 million in real market value, and engaged in a manufacturing or processing activity. In 2014, we generated a roll value of approximately $25 billion. Combined in 2014, we do all of this appraisal work on behalf of the Oregon counties. So once we do our appraisal work, we then send the values off to the counties, who then take that information to generate tax bills. In 2014, the combined tax bills were approximately $500 million of tax revenue.
Yes, thank you. Going back to the central assessment, that's property tax, personal property, and then intangibles. How do you go about determining the value of intangibles of a company, particularly a company wholly within the state of Oregon, and also something, say, of a Google that is all over the country?
Senator Thatcher, members of the committee. We're mislabeled here. Senator Whitsitt, I apologize. Members of the committee.
She's a lot better looking than I am.
What we're tasked with doing is appraising companies who are engaged in a centrally accessible business or service. Typically what we do is we look at companies at a more global basis. So it could be if they're operating outside of the state of Oregon, we could be looking at financial information for a company that could be global, could be international. We then appraise that company, and then we have the task of allocating property and values back to Oregon based upon best practices, statute, administrative rule references. with the goal of identifying just the amount of property, which includes both tangible and intangible components in Oregon. It's a challenge. It's big when you're talking about major companies like Google, Comcast. It can be a rather lengthy endeavor. But we do that through using industry appraisal best practices. Mm-hmm. Does that get to the heart of your question?
Yeah, just to follow up briefly, let's just take, I mean, just off the top of my head, Microsoft, Intel's in Oregon. At one time, Intel's stock was selling for 45 times earnings. So there was a huge amount of blue sky because they're Intel. How do you go about determining the value of that? Do you charge them full bore for the stock value, or do you have some kind of a sliding scale because the stock market goes up and down, or you know, the one quarter of bad earnings and they drop half. So,
yeah. Senator Whitsitt, members of the committee, that is a challenge we have with centrally assessing property. We use best appraisal practice to value companies, and what we do is we use three approaches to valuing these companies, and that would look at what their market value is on the public exchanges. So if they're a publicly traded company, and not every company that we centrally assess is publicly traded, but for those that are, we definitely use that information in our analysis. We look at income information. So a typical filing or an audited financial on a company, what's their income and expense information, and we try to project that out and discount it back to present values. We also look at, what's the cost of the company? What did they cost to not only construct all of their assets, their tangible assets, but what did they do in acquiring other businesses and services, which would be some part of their intangible value? We factor all of those in, which is best appraisal industrial practices, and to come up with a value that we feel is appropriate for a company. Not every time we're right, and we get appeals, and that's a part of the process as well.
Thank you.
So why don't we back up to the prior slide, sorry. Okay. So as I said, the DOR's purpose is to develop real market value on behalf of Oregon counties. In 2014, we generated about $500 million in tax revenue. Over the last 10 years, we have seen an increase in the number of accounts that we have responsibility of appraising, as well as the complexity of the types of accounts that we are appraising. We've talked about some of them here already, Google and the Comcasts. They are definitely complex in not only the scope, but the magnitude of their property. And staff have actually been decreasing over the last 10 years. So to manage this appraisal endeavor and the complexity of the appraisal endeavor, we have relied on technology. So it's not just a benefit to the work we do, but it's vital in our mission to get statutory values out in a timely manner. Next slide, please. So the software applications available for valuation are a combination of homegrown applications, databases, and Excel spreadsheets. Nothing is integrated, and it makes it very difficult to do our appraisal work. This limited capability can be highlighted by, I'll touch upon both of our appraisal programs, and the first is the industrial program. In February of each year, like I'm staring at the microphone here, sorry. In February of each year, industrial property owners mail a return to the department that has a listing of all their assets. So it lists information about their buildings, machinery and equipment, and all the business personal property that they have. We then have the task of collecting that information and storing it in a usable area so that we can begin our appraisal work. We do that, we collect and store in primarily Excel. And that is for companies that submit information electronically. We don't have a traditional e-file option. We have developed somewhat of a workaround at the department, which is an Excel spreadsheet that we've developed that mimics what the paper application looks like. And then we actually load it onto CDs and send it out to the taxpayers, who then can, transmit data onto it and send it back to us.
I'm going to ask you to maybe summarize a little bit faster, because we've got another group to present. If you could go through a little, maybe skip some of the things that are not as important.
Co-Chair Riley. I will definitely try to speed this up a little bit. Just looking at the industrial program and the central assessment program together, we utilize Excel homegrown databases, one that was developed over 15 years ago and really has no functional uses other than to maintain some historical record of what the company's name is and account number numbers and information is. We don't have any centralization. We collect information in one area, store it in files, and then transport it manually into others. We have no real usable fields for using appraisal standards and industry standards in the work that we do. Commercially developed applications are available and have been available and widely used in taxation programs at the state level and the local level for decades. There are off-the-shelf products that fully integrate the appraisal process that collect and store information electronically that would allow us to not only collect the information but do our appraisal analysis in real time rather than moving from a paper file or an Excel spreadsheet. It improves the customer service where there's an ability to file, recall information at the customer level. It also gives, as I said, we do work on behalf of counties. It gives them some confidence that we're using appraisal standards in what we're doing. We're not simply moving between internally developed spreadsheets to do our work. So there is some credibility there at stake. We're also looking for a COTS, commercially developed application, that where a vendor provides long-term maintenance agreements that will update, support, and maintain the system long-term. So that gets us into a long-term solution where we don't have to worry about whether or not we're using the current technology or not. And everything that we're looking to do here is to maintain our appraisal process and not detract from the work that we do. The project costs that we have developed here for you were developed with an RFI that we put out in 2014. We've been working with counties who are currently or have recently updated their systems, as well as our own internal CSR PMO office's experiences. The total project cost over 4 years we're anticipating to be $3.3 million, with a 2015-17 biennium of about $2.3 million. This is all in the bonding authority that we're looking to achieve. It includes, in the just a high level, it includes the software and the hardware necessary, as well as hiring staff to just implement the project, quality assurance, and a long-term maintenance agreement. And lastly, the project timeline is what we have here is a 2015-17 biennium representation. If we begin the project and get the bonding authority in summer, we would do our hiring, and the staff would then begin to develop the RFP and vendor select, hopefully early 2016. At that time, we would then obviously revise and adjust that based upon the vendor's recommendations. What I'd like to state here is that this project will not negatively affect CSR. Implementation wouldn't begin until the end of 2016, early 2017, which is in the final phase 3-4 of the CSR rollout. However, if there is a perceived conflict, this would definitely take a back seat and the priority of CSR being fully implemented would be realized. We think this is a prudent time to begin this process simply because we don't want to lose the institutional knowledge that we have with Eric Smith's and Terrence's guidance of implementing CSR. We want to take advantage of that for PVS to make sure that we identify all the potential pitfalls and risks associated with an IT project and develop a mitigation strategy.
Any final questions? Thank you very much.
Chair Riley, members of the committee, next up on the agenda, we have the Public Employees Retirement System. Pleased to have Steve Rodeman, the Executive Director for PERS, and Jordan Masanga, the Chief Information Officer for PERS. Gentlemen.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee, and especially to the LFO staff for the opportunity. We're before you today to talk to you about our IT overview. As Mr. McSpaden said, we're We're relatively new in our roles. I'm in my third month as executive director. Jordan's been our CIO for about 14 months. But we both have been veterans through the project that got us to where we are at today, and are pleased to tell you of our progress in that, and also the future strategies that we're implementing to try to leverage that technology.
Just for the record, could you say your name, please?
Steve Rodman. So I'm going to turn it over to Jordan to talk about the IT governance and services profile, and then he'll take you through our current status, and I'll come back in the end and talk about some of the major projects we have coming up in the next biennium.
Chair Riley, Chair Nathanson, my name is Jordan Sanga, for the record. I'm the Information Services Division Administrator and Chief Information Officer. I am the leader of the IT group at PERS. I've been with PERS, the agency, for 12 years. As Mr. Rubin has said, I've been in my position, my current position, for about 14 months. I want to go through a little bit about the division. We have about 55 FTEs, 17 of it are in the imaging group. We are grouped in functions. Our current LAB or budget is 23.4. Current expenditure throughout through the end of the biennium is 23.06. So real quickly, I want to give you a rear view image of a project that we completed back in 2011. We started in 2003. It was the reform, PERS reform. In 2003, we replaced our monolithic mainframe system to more of a modern system. As revenue are doing right now, we've actually completed that. As a result, we had we have a new system called Orion. Orion stands for Oregon Retirement Online Network. So the Orion system is actually made up a number of line of business applications. The largest one in that is called JClarity, which is our retirement administration system, which we reformed, as well as other applications that are important to the business. Orion also has some external facing portals, one of them being called OMS, which is the member online system service. As well as EDX, which stands for the Employer Data Exchange, so both the member and the employer portal access. Of course, we have our internal Orion system that our staff uses. So just really quickly about some of the things that has happened since RCP. As I mentioned, we finished the project in 2011, but officially we finished it with the warranty expiring in 2014 of the last November. Part of that is a lot of retraining of some of our staff from the mainframe COBOL world to a more of an object-oriented world. With RCP being completed, all along the project, we knew that we wouldn't cover 100% of our needs. So some of the things that we have to deal with is the 80-20 rule, so 20% of it, we're still looking into how to enhance the system better, and I'm going to talk about that later. So part of that conversion project, we also had some data quality issues that we are continuously addressing, as well as changes in the business side, the business and how business process things, that too also has changed. However, since the deployment in 2011, we have deployed over 1,500 changes to the system, which I think shows a lot of the capability my staff has. So one of the things that I do want to quickly give you a overview is IT doesn't do things on their own. We do have a governance process. We have a committee, a project steering committee, that essentially allocates the resource for all these projects. It's comprised of the executive leadership team, and it's facilitated and ran by the PMO. We do have monthly meetings to go through all the projects. We also have to determine, you know, where we spend the IT dollars that makes sense. And then aside in cooperation with the project steering committee, we have an Orion steering committee that really focuses on the priority. So we have all this work, but we also need to determine where which work should we be doing first. So the committee meets on a biweekly basis to go through the number of priorities as well as how to integrate some of the changes that that are being introduced to the system. For example, the legislature changes, as well as some of the other things such as IRS and then Department of Revenue change tax tables for withholding. So those are external forces that requires some maintenance enhancements. So one of the things I did was back last summer, I wanted to pull all the business folks in as well as IT into one room and spent the whole day strategizing. In other words, how can IT provide better services to our business? So I had people focus on a focus question, essentially how can IT enable the transformation of to a process-driven organization? As a result, we had five critical capabilities that were identified. Service-oriented staff, agile technology system, data management and analytics, organizational change management, and adaptive governance model. I won't go through that in detail, but those are very important as I plan out the next biennium in the next few years. And that is a strategy that I am using to plan out future projects. So one of the things that we wanted to do was have a budget that makes sense. So based on the strategies, we identified so many things we want to invest in. So one of the things I want to introduce is a policy action package that really allows Orion to be more flexible. Right now, it's really hard to integrate other applications to it. So one of the things that we are going to do is build a enterprise service bus, which allows other applications to loosely integrate into Orion. Another thing that I am looking to do with another policy option package is to address some of the architecture deficiencies. So when large conversion projects like we went through, there were things that weren't clearly defined or weren't defined very well. So there are some flaws in the system. So I want to take some time to fix those flaws so I can continue to build a better system for our business. Lastly, another policy option package is to define and develop a disaster recovery plan, as well as updating a business continuity plan.
So one of the policy option packages that Jordan referenced was POP 102, where we're going as it's been numbered. And I wanted to elaborate on how that fits into our post-project governance world. The individual account program is a program that was started in 2003 legislation. First contributions came in 2004. And it's where all member contributions go now and are invested. So it's a growing program. In the last year, we had about almost 250,000 participants, and the account balances keep growing. They're averaging about $25,000 each right now. So over the last 10 years, it's grown into a significant portion of a member's retirement planning, where previously, as members retired and took out their individual account balances, it maybe wasn't a significant dollar amount. But as people, as those balances grow and as it becomes a more mature program, the distribution of those funds in line with how people plan their retirement is going to be very important. So we could not in the few months between the passage of the 2003 legislation and the creation of the IAP contributions coming in with January 2004, we couldn't build a system in time to manage that. So we turned to a third-party administrator, and that third-party administrator was retained for record-keeping and for participant services. So the third-party administrator keeps the record of how much is in each account and processes the distributions. So we do some of the administrative functions. We collect the contributions from the members, and we invest the contributions through the Oregon Investment Council as part of our investment practices. And then we credit earnings or determine how much of earnings to credit to those accounts. And then it gets turned over to the third-party administrator to actually manage the member relationship. So that's not a very satisfactory structure for our members and for our agency, because members are consistently being passed back and forth. Their information is being passed back and forth. And we thought we could do a better job if that administration was brought in-house. All of those features then were concentrated within the agency. So starting in the 13-15 budget, we engaged in a project to fully integrate all those IAP functions into Orion and eliminate the TPA. So that POP is about a $2 million request in the next biennium. We've spent, if I recall, roughly $1.5 million this biennium. So for $3.5 million over two biennia, we're eliminating TPA costs in perpetuity that are about $2 million a year. So you're making an upfront investment to eliminate this cost over time, a big and I think very clear ROI. So just to show you visually what this change in administration looks like, this is a map of our current processes. And I apologize to Representative Nathanson and Senator Whitsitt. You've seen this before last year when we reported to you. But the details of this don't really matter, because the next slide shows you what goes away if we take on the administration. So all the boxes that have X's through them are steps in the process that get eliminated once that administration is brought in-house to PERS. And I think it shows very clearly that concentrating the administration within PERS allows us to turn transactions more quickly and efficiently and reduce costs dramatically through the program. And every dollar we don't have to spend to administer the program is a dollar that's returned back to the member in earnings. So this is what we're trying to accomplish through the change in the IAP administration. Currently, we're in phase two of that project. We completed phase one in this biennium, again, on time and under budget. Phase two is proceeding, and I'll let Jordan give you an update on where we're at in phase two, because one of the things that we're experiencing, of course, is the change in the project oversight between DAS and LFO. And since we're in the midst of this project, that change in oversight has kind of changed how we need to deal with those entities. And I'll let Jordan explain where we're at with that process.
So as Mr. Rubin has mentioned, we're just a few months away from completing phase two. Part of the phase two activity is to work with DAS to make sure we have all the stage gate deliverables provided. As well as working with LFO to make sure all the independent quality assurance is covered. We did engage with a quality assurance vendor. They are on site today, and they will be providing a initial risk assessment report to DAS and LFO in the next coming weeks. As a result of completion of phase two, the next phase is phase three, which is POP 102, which allows us to continue the construction and deploy into production. So one of the things I also want to cover are some of the non-budget related initiatives. So part of IT is to improve service delivery on our maintenance enhancements. So maintenance enhancements are things that we have to continue feeding and carrying our system. So things I'll be working with and focusing on is improving our quality deliverables so we can reduce the defects when we work, as well as refining our IT governance within PERS. So one of the things we are looking into is moving our ITIL maturity level from a level 1 to level 3, as well as documentation of our Orion enterprise architecture and establishing some standards and guidelines. So if you look back in 2003 of August, when we embarked on HB 2020 PERS reform, we've come a long ways since that. And we are on our way to completing another milestone, which is the IEP admin administration, bringing that in-house in June of 2017.
So just to kind of lay out some key takeaways from the experience that we've had, revenues going through a major IT conversion project, as I just explained, we're coming off of one. It's interesting to compare and contrast some of the governance and IT administration challenges that each of those states present to you. The first key takeaway for us is that we needed to evolve and are continually evolving our governance structures. When you're in major project mode like revenue is in, what everybody needs to work on every day is really clear, because that project is the priority of everybody who has a piece of it and touches it. And the needs of other people that are not involved in that project are subsumed, because the project has a timeline and a cost, and failure is not an option. So we're in an environment now where we've moved beyond that. We have some breathing space, and the question for the governance structure of our agency then is, what is the next thing you work on? Given the allocation of resources that you have available, and that's where we picked up the IAP, because we saw that as the next big area where we can concentrate our IT technology to leverage what we have and provide improved services to our members. So it's a much smaller project in scale, obviously, but you follow a lot of the same disciplines. And you, having been through that major project experience, you have the same muscles that you are exercising to try to run on a smaller scale. But making the choice to do that is the challenge of governance in making sure everybody recognizes this is the next priority, and again, this is the thing that moves to the front of the line, as opposed to some of the other needs that may have arisen during the period of time that the major project was going on. The second key takeaway we want to emphasize is a term Jordan has taught me, which is called technical debt. Here we sit in 2015 with a system that we started contracting for back in 2003. You're not using the same cell phone you had 12 years ago, I'd venture to guess. Technology has evolved, and capabilities of technology have evolved. When you're in the midst of a project, you can't always incorporate those kinds of things into what you're doing, because you bought a piece of a system and hardware and structure. You bought that, and that's what's got to get executed over a number of years, and it's obsolete, or not state-of-the-art, I should say, by the time it gets implemented. So there seem to be a lot of plane analogies in IT. I heard Terrence use one. And the one Jordan is always telling me is you can't always maintain the plane while it's in the air. There are times when you got to land and fix what you need to fix when the plane is on the ground, instead of trying to keep going all the time. So that's what technical debt is about for us, and what POP 104, or piece of POP 104, is about, is taking the time to actually rebuild some of the basic architecture of our system so it works better, and so we can make it more nimble and more responsive in the future. And that's the third takeaway, is that there will be change. No matter how well you went into this system development, coming out of it, you will have learned things you should have done better, and coming out of it, the world will change around you. So whether it's legislative policy changes that we need to implement or what we have as process changes that we decide would be a better way to serve our members, there is always going to be a need to maintain and enhance the system that you have, because if you strand that investment, you lose the value of what you've created, and instead it's going to take constant feeding to make sure that it stays current and capable. So just because we had a major project investment doesn't mean that's the last ask that we are going to come to our members on the General Government Subcommittee and ask for as far as technology investments. They, as you see, we'll see several POPs this session that help us to continue to leverage the technology investment that has already been made. So with that, we appreciate the opportunity to come before you and are open, of course, to any questions you might have.
Questions? Yes.
Thank you. What I don't know about IT systems does fill volumes, but this is a system that is what started in 2003, and obviously you are making around 500 adjustments to it a year in order to keep it up and running and current. Is there a point in time when that, for better lack of a better term, the mainframe of the whole software program becomes obsolete and you can no longer adjust it to the modern? I'm thinking along the lines of a Microsoft 5 as opposed to a Microsoft 10. I mean, if you have the old one, it doesn't work. Is there a point in time when you're going to have to redo the whole thing, or can you continue to evolve as you go along?
Co-Chair Riley and Senator Whitsitt, I think Jordan will give you a much more technical answer. What I would say from my experience is what we're learning is the ability to leverage what you have better than trying to scrap what you have and build new again. He talked about the IAP being based on an enterprise service bus, which basically takes the information from your old system, puts it into a modern portal so that it can be used more efficiently and effectively. That is a technology that came 2 or 3 years too late for us. Had that technology been more mature at the time we built or started on the RIMS conversion project, we might have built it under that structure. What we're talking about with technical debt is, and the changes we're making, is not that the technology is obsolete, but there's better ways to manage it. We have hundreds of tables of data, and that all has to get pulled at different points to execute a transaction. There's better ways to do that all the time, and we're trying to build a better way to manage that data. So it doesn't become obsolete, but I think it can be worked better. Is there anything you'd want to add to that?
Sure. Senator, was it members of the committee? So I'm part of a group called PRISM, Public Retirement Information Management System. So I'm one of 50-plus systems across the country, and they took a poll. They asked all the systems across the country, how long does your system last until you have to divest it and invest in something else? The general response was 10 years average. So if you apply that to PERS here, we've passed that. So we started in 2003, we passed it in 2013. So we're at the maturity of our current system. So we will come to a point where we will have to make some major decisions. One of them could be converting again. Or the other option is what we're doing with IAP is extending Orion by using technology to do that. So we're using technology to extend the life of our system.
The genesis of my question was this particular slide right here, where you're upgrading and you're going to be able to run it with, you're investing now to be able to run it with a lot less people, and
right,
it will pay itself back. And I'm wondering how long you will be able to do that until you have to, for a better lack of a better term, scrap the program and start with something new and build off it.
Co-Chair Riley and Senator Whitsitt, thank you for clarifying. The challenge with the IEP administration is not what's done, but who's doing it. And the problem is that we've got the who's doing it spread across us and the TPA. So there's a lot of back and forth as far as we develop information, we hand it to you, you do something with it, you hand it back to us. That's what's getting eliminated, is the handoffs and the passing offs. So that's not a technology solution. That kind of efficiency never goes away, because you just don't have to engage that TPA anymore. The basis of the technology we're building is fundamental to our business. We collect data, we calculate a benefit, we pay it out. That's what we always do. We're just adding another type of benefit payment to that structure by taking the IEP in-house. And building that structure is like what Jordan was saying. There's going to be better ways to do that in the future. And we'll try to extend what we have now for as long as it's reasonable to do so. And hopefully it will be the next executive director and CIO that come back to you with the system replacement, because we'll have made this one last as long as we can.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
So any other questions for these folks? Yes,
Senator Riley, members of the committee, I don't have a question, but I did want to commend Mr. Edelman, Jordan, and the previous management at PERS. I will tell you, in the area of information technology oversight, both the executive branch and the legislative branch learned a lot from the RIMS conversion project. Some of the key takeaways you've identified in the area of governance, in particular, the level of involvement by executive management, by program managers, the business side of the agency, that this is not a part-time endeavor. This is not something that can be turned over to the technology professionals in an agency, that it really takes, for this kind of project, a major IT project that involves all areas of the business, that has to include executive leadership on really a daily basis. That's one piece. The other, I would say, they took the step of hiring a professional project management firm that had direct and lengthy experience and domain knowledge in this particular area. And that was critical to the success of this project. Having someone who'd done it more than once with this magnitude of project was very helpful. Another really was the commitment of the agency to having independent and internal quality assurance and quality control. They embraced that. They didn't see it as a burden. In fact, used it to their advantage. We certainly have tried to tap their experience, share it with the Department of Revenue, with the Judicial Department on eCourt, many of the other large IT projects you see today that are doing a bit better, that are adopting commercially available technology as opposed to always going down the custom development path. Some of those lessons came from PERS, and I want to thank you for your work.
Thank you, Sean. And I appreciate that as well. any closing thoughts? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to adjourn. Adjourn.